Yeah. And then
Now let me Okay, you're a host now. The recording is started. Everybody's admitted.
and you've
Go for
disabled
it.
the waiting room, so they'll come right in. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Oh, hello, friends. Welcome to this 96th webinar on the Secret Doctrine, which marks completion of our 8th year together. I wonder how, I know a couple of you were there in the very beginning. I wonder how many. It's a long time ago. This month, we'll continue with Sylvia Cranston's HPB, The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky. So, this is a three-reader segment. So, BL.
Okay, I don't, we don't see your presentation, we just see you.
Oh,
So it's,
the share went away. Okay, let me get that back.
sorry, that was,
There we go.
okay. Let's start with Scott and then Martha and then Barbara, please.
Okay. Helena not only immersed herself in the story she heard or read, she told her own. Vera, Helena's sister, relates, at about 10 versts, roughly 7 miles, from the governor's villa, there was a field, an extensive sandy tract of land, evidently once upon a time the bottom of a sea or a great lake, as its soil yielded petrified relics of fishes, shells, and teeth of some, to us, unknown monsters. Most of these relics were broken and mangled by time, but one could often find whole stones of various sizes, on which were imprinted figures of fishes and plants and animals of kinds now wholly extinct, but which proved their undeniable antediluvian origin. The marvelous and sensational stories that we, children and schoolgirls, heard from Helena during that epic were countless.
Scott, next.
Martha? Oh, Barbara. Go ahead, Barbara.
No, I had to unmute. I'm sorry. I well remember when stretched at full length on the ground, her chin reclining on her two palms and her two elbows buried deep in the soft sand. She used to dream aloud and tell us of her visions, evidently clear, vivid, and as palpable as life to her. How lovely the description she gave us of the submarine life of all those beings, the mangled remains of which were now crumbling to dust around us. How vividly she described their past fights and battles on the spot where she lay, assuring us she saw it all, and how minutely she drew on the sand with her finger the fantastic forms of the long dead sea monsters, and made us almost see the very colors of the fauna and flora of these dead regions. Helena spoke of reincarnation even in those early days.
Thank you, Martha. And finally,
It was her delight to gather around herself a party of us younger children at twilight, and after taking us into the large, dark museum of her grandmother's house, to hold us there spellbound with her weird stories. Each of the stuffed animals in the museum had taken her in turn into its confidence, had divulged to her the history of its life in previous incarnations or existences. Where had she heard of reincarnation, or who could have taught her anything of the superstitious mysteries of metempsychosis in a Christian family? Yet she would stretch herself on her favorite animal, a gigantic stuffed seal, and caressing its silvery, soft, white skin. She would repeat to us his adventures as told to her by himself, in such glowing colors and eloquent style that even grown-up persons found themselves involuntarily interested in her narratives.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay. In the beginning of our last session, HPB pointed out that humanity's understanding of how its psychic, spiritual, and mental apparatus relates to its physical functions is in almost complete confusion because modern society has lost its connection with the ageless wisdom, as expressed, for example, through ancient Hindu and Egyptian systems of thought. She goes on to say that until humanity accepts the septenary division of the human constitution, it will, quote, be forever impossible to understand the metaphysical and purely psychic and even physiological relations between the Dhyan Chohans, or angels on the one hand, on the one plane, and humanity on the other. We then took a look at the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which details the deceased's stages of purification and the sequential disengagement from its seven principles during his or her post-mortem journey of the soul. HPB then makes a case for the ancient Egyptians' belief in reincarnation, suggesting that the solar bark, which travels through the underworld at night to reemerge in the light of day, is a metaphor for the cycle of death and rebirth of a human being. To strengthen her argument, she references spell 143 from the Book of the Dead, which, according to HPB, describes the soul's cyclical journey. We then took a look at spell 51, which describes 14 mounds, each inhabited or guarded by distinct entities, serpents, beings who breathe fire, and other guardians. These mounds are initiatory gates that represent obstacles, trials, or stages of transformation that the soul must confront and overcome in order to progress towards eternal life. Each mound is associated with a specific challenge or power, and by naming or invoking the beings within a particular mound, the deceased gained empowerment and protection. The 14th mound is described as the edge of all known things, guarded by beings whose eyes see truth and whose tongues speak flame. Next, we learn about the seven nature powers of the Egyptian moon god Thot-Es-Mum, which HPV suggests represent the form aspect of our seven principles. These principles are also represented by the seven rays of the Chaldean Heptactus, or Iao, on the Gnostic stones. You can see them emanating from this serpent-bodied, lion-headed figure. HPB then turns to the true ancient source of these septenary principles. Quote, the first form of the mystical seven was seen to be figured in heaven by the seven large stars of the Great Bear, the constellation assigned by the Egyptians to the mother of time and of the seven elemental powers. It's easy to see how the Egyptians associated the mother of time with the Great Bear's yearly revolution around the pole, as it forms a kind of seasonal clock. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. I want to invite you to participate by asking questions or giving comments anytime. Dialogue is always more interesting than monologue. So jump in when you have something to say. Okay, we'll back up just a bit to start this session. Quote, the human being and their esotericism came out from the moon, a triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical at once. He crossed the whole cycle of existence and then returned to his birthplace. Sorry. Before issuing from it again. So this is a complex, multi-layered statement. First, the human being came out from the moon refers to the past in general and to the moon chain in particular, the realm of humanity's previous development. A triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical. Astronomically, the moon is a remnant of the moon chain, a dead body that once sustained life. Though physiologically, it still influences the human body by regulating fertility cycles, tides, and other growth rhythms. Psychically, the moon symbolizes the astral body, memory, and past karmic residues. He crossed the whole cycle of existence, refers to the rounds and races through which the long pilgrimage of the soul takes place. Return to his birthplace before issuing from it again suggests that before the soul can move forward into higher evolution, it has to return to and resolve its lunar inheritance, the karmic, astral, and bodily residues of the past. Only then can it, quote, issue forth again into a new cycle of spiritual life. Thoughts or questions? Okay. Next. Thus the defunct is shown arriving in the West, receiving his judgment before Osiris, resurrecting as the god Horus, and circling round the sidereal heavens, which is an allegorical assimilation to Ra, the sun. So another super packed statement. The West is, in Egyptian thought, the portal through which the deceased enters the Duat, the underworld. There, the soul stands before Osiris, lord of the underworld, at which time the heart of the deceased is weighed against the feather of Maat, symbol of truth and order, to determine whether the soul can continue its upward journey. So here's the heart, here's the feather of Maat. If the soul is deemed worthy, the deceased is reborn in the form of Horus. As a divine son, think soul-infused personality, right? The resurrected soul then joins the stars, the hierarchy, the higher, etheric subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, circling eternally in the heavens, and is thereby assimilated into the cosmic order. An allegorical assimilation to Ra, the sun, means that this entire process of transitioning into the higher realms is symbolized by the daily cycle of the sun of Ra moving through the heavens. And then finally, then having crossed the Nut, the celestial abyss, returning once more to the Tiau, an assimilation to Osiris, who, as the god of life and reproduction, inhabits the moon. Okay, so Nut, is the Egyptian sky goddess whose arched body forms the heavens to quote unquote cross the Nut, means to pass through the celestial abyss, the great divide between the worlds of the living and the dead. In Egyptian mythology, Ra is swallowed by Nut at sunset and reborn from her at dawn. This symbolizes the soul's passage through the cosmic night, the interval between death and rebirth. After crossing this celestial abyss, the soul reincarnates into physical life, the outer shadow world of purification and testing. An assimilation to Osiris means assimilating the lessons of death and rebirth. Who, as the god of life and reproduction, inhabits the moon, ties Osiris to the lunar principle where the soul is gestated before a new incarnation. Any thoughts or questions? So through this whole section, HPB is making the effort successfully, in my opinion, to bring us into an awareness that the Egyptian mystery school was a profound representation of the ageless wisdom teachings, that the theosophical tenets that we study are found and represented in the mythology of the Egyptians, as well as the Babylonians and the ancient Hindus. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Plutarch, Isis, and Osiris show the Egyptians celebrating a festival called the Ingress of Osiris into the Moon. The chapter, that's 21,
Done.
11, sorry. Are you hearing this noise or
Yeah,
you're
but it's
okay?
okay. Go ahead.
Okay. The chapter 11, Life is Promised After Death, and the renovation of life is placed under the patronage of Osiris Lunus. Because the moon was the symbol of life, renewals, or reincarnation, owing to its growth, waning, dying, and reappearing every month. In the Ndalkmo 4.5, it is said, O Osiris Lunus, that renews to thee thy renewal. And Sefaket says to Seti, I, Maret Abydos, plate 51,
That's
though renew.
Seti the first. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yes, you're right. Seti the first, Maret Abydos, plate 51, though renewest thyself as the god Lunus when a babe, it is still better explained in a Louvre papyrus. P. Pierret, Études de French, I don't know. Egyptologies, coupling and conception abound when he, Osiris Lunus, is seen in heaven on that day. Says Osiris, O sole radiant beam of the moon, I issue from the circulating multitude of stars. Open me the tail for Osiris N. One will issue
I
by day. I will issue by day to do what I have to do amongst the living. Book of the Dead, chapter second. Example to produce conception. Sorry, I butchered that.
Oh, it's a really thick passage, so you did great. No problem there. Okay, so first, Plutarch, Isis and Osiris, chapter 43, shows. That's his book, Plutarch's book, shows the Egyptians celebrating a festival called the Ingress of Osiris into the Moon. So Plutarch wrote his book, Isis and Osiris, while he was serving as a priest at Delphi between 100 and 20 AD. You know, for those of you who in the last session of the Secret Teachings of All Ages, we talked about this period. It was the last few hundred years of the Delphi of Oracle, and he actually was a priest there. In chapter 43, we learned that the Egyptians celebrated a festival marking Osiris's entry into the moon. So Osiris entering the moon symbolized the soul's entry into the lunar sphere after death, the underworld, the Tuat, where it undergoes purification and renewal before rebirth. This was described in some of those spells, for instance, the one with the 14 mounds, where you're constantly given tests and trials, which the purpose of being purification. Next, in chapter 41, life is promised after death. And the renovation of life is placed under the patronage of Osiris Lunus, because the moon was the symbol of life renewals or reincarnations, owing to its growth, waning, dying, and reappearance every month. So Osiris is the guarantor of resurrection, right? The moon was seen as the symbol of life's renewal because of its monthly cycle, waxing, waning, disappearing, and reappearing. Osiris, as Osiris Lunus, presides over this cycle, embodying the principle of reincarnation and regeneration. You know, part of the genius of the Egyptian was their ability to combine these deities, because they recognized that they were essentially energy streams, and so they were not hung up on the personas, and saw them these combinations a way of particularizing, of pointing to specific energy applications, right? Like this one, Osiris Lunus, right? Okay. Next, I see a hand.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Yes, so both Osiris and Isis, I think, as you have pointed out, operate as an energy stream on several different levels. They have a personality form in some of the Egyptian lore. They are gods that are helping Egypt, actually bringing wheat to Egypt. And then they have their celestial form in Sirius and the Blue Lodge. So I thank you for that energy stream, because that's really what it is, rather than something definite at a certain level.
Right. Yeah. It's definite at many levels, would be one way of saying it. You know, it's the genius of being able to particularize, you know, the energy stream that's being described by combining these forms, these different god-like, or not god-like, these streams that are personified by deity. But the Egyptians really, they understood that essentially it was the energy that flowed through them. They became focal points for these energies, depending on the purpose of the energy. Okay, so in the Dankmo, stanza 4, verse 5, or chapter 4, fifth line, it is said, "O Osiris Lunus, that renews to thee thy renewal." The Dankmo is a Coptic late Egyptian funerary text. The phrase, O Osiris Lunus, that renews to thee thy renewal, confirms the Egyptian belief in the cyclical immortality of Osiris, and by extension, the soul that is assimilated to him. You see that? That renews to thee thy renewal addresses this cyclical immortality. Next, and Safek says to Seti I, Mariette's Abydos Plate 51, thou renewest thyself as the god Lunas when a babe. This inscription comes from the Abydos Temple of Seti I. Absolutely fabulous temple, by the way. If you go to Egypt, put that at the top of your list. It has the most extraordinary bas-reliefs. The artisanship was absolutely fabulous. In this inscription, the goddess Safek, here, seeing it right, and better known as Seshat, the goddess of writing, record keeping, and sacred time, addresses the pharaoh with these words, thus affirming the pharaoh's place in the eternal rhythm of cosmic renewal. So she's the one that says these words, thou renewest thyself as the god Lunas when a babe, right? This is important because it extends renewal and thus reincarnation, not just to the gods, but also to the pharaohs, and by extension, to humankind. The wording, thou renewest thyself as the god Lunas when a babe, emphasizes new birth, right? That's when the renewal takes place. So the pharaoh is reborn like the young moon, the crescent that appears after the dark night. And finally, it is still better explained in a Louvre papyrus, P. Period, Etude Egyptologique. Couplings and conceptions abound when he, Osiris Lunas, is seen in heaven on that day. Says Osiris, O soul, radiant beam of the moon, I issue from the circulating multitudes of stars. Open me the Tiau, for Osiris N, I will issue by day to do what I have to do among the living. That's from Book of the Dead, Chapter 2. That is to produce conceptions. Okay, there's a lot here. Pires Etude Egyptologique, which cites an Egyptian papyrus now in the Louvre collection. All right. The first quote reads, couplings and conceptions abound when he, Osiris Lunas, is seen in heaven on that day. Meaning that when Osiris is identified with the moon, he becomes the cosmic power of renewal and generation. The papyrus, see, that's going back to what Barbara was saying. Through identification with the moon, he lends that quality of renewal and generation to the form aspect. The papyrus then has Osiris speak, O soul, radiant beam of the moon, I issue from the circulating multitudes of stars. In ancient Egypt, the moon was seen as the Eye of Horus, restored. Eye of Horus, restored. The light of Osiris shining again after his death. O soul, radiant beam of the moon, is not addressed to someone else, but is a self-identification formula used in Egyptian funerary texts. You often found this addressing the self in these ways. It's really a form of identification, right? Of stating one's identification. Thus, Osiris is identifying with the beams that emerge from the cosmic abyss, carrying with it the life force hidden in the heavens. From a theosophical perspective, the moon represents the form aspect, the weight of past karma, and the endless cycle of rebirth. Yet within that lunar darkness, there shines a quote-unquote soul radiant beam, the spark of consciousness that belongs to the soul. The last statement in this passage reads, "Open me to the Tiau, for Osiris-En, I will issue by day to do what I have to do amongst the living." Here, Osiris asks for the gates of the Tiau to be opened so that he, or the deceased, called here Osiris-En, which is a placeholder for the name of the deceased, it's like, put your name here, that's what the en means, right? May emerge into the day. To quote unquote issue by day is the central theme of the Book of the Dead, the soul's resurrection into new life. To do what I have to do amongst the living suggests a continuation on the path of becoming. Okay, any thoughts or questions? HPB is presenting all this as proof of ancient Egypt's belief in the ageless wisdom in general and reincarnation in particular. You know, she's giving us examples of teachings, passages that poke a hole through what traditional Egyptologists believe to be the belief system of the ancient Egyptians, which was one life, and if you lived it badly, you were, you know, thrown into the mouth of the waiting crocodile, and if you lived it well, then you ascend to the heavens, period. You know, that was it. It's funny how that mirrors the Christian belief of hell and heaven, you know. But she's, you know, she's bringing up these subtleties to, in some cases, not that subtle, to, you know, underscore the fact that the Egyptians did believe in reincarnation. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that, please?
Osiris was God manifest in generation, because the ancients knew far better than the moderns the real occult influences of the lunar body upon the mysteries of conception. Later on, when the moon became connected with female goddesses, with Diana, Isis, Artemis, Juno, etc., that connection was due to a thorough knowledge of physiology and female nature, physical as much as psychic. So the asterisk means in the oldest systems we find the moon always, oh, sorry, we find the moon always male. Thus, Soma is, with the Hindus, a kind of sidereal Don Juan, a king and the father, albeit illegitimate, of Buddha, with, sorry, of Buddha wisdom, which, sorry, not quite sure how to read this, which relates to occult knowledge, a wisdom gathered through a thorough acquaintance with lunar mysteries, including those of sexual generation. See Holy of Holies.
Yeah, you read it correctly. It's Buddha wisdom, right? Okay, first, Osiris was God manifest in generation because the ancients knew far better than the moderns the real occult influences of the lunar body upon the mysteries of conception. So there are two themes here. Osiris is the god of fertility and rebirth, and the moon as the regulator of conception and generation. The Egyptians saw, a complete merging of these into this entity, Osiris Lunus. Osiris is not the only ruler of the dead, but is, no, I'm sorry, Osiris is not only the ruler of the dead, but is also the principle of life, fertility, and reproduction. Thus, he embodies the mystery of generations, one of his key aspects, the power by which life continually renews itself. That's why Set cut him into all these pieces, and why, which Isis then went around and gathered up, and the last piece to be found was the phallus, which is, of course, was that part of him that embodied the mystery of generation. Excuse me. He's the one who makes sure that crops sprout, that animal and human bodies regenerate, and that souls are reborn. He was associated with the moon because the Egyptians believed that lunar cycles actually regulated conception and generation. Let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the phrase mysteries of conception. In the oldest systems, we find the moon always male. Thus, Soma is, with the Hindus, a kind of sidereal Don Juan, a king and the father, albeit illegitimate, of Buddha wisdom, which relates to occult knowledge, a wisdom gathered through a thorough acquaintance with lunar mysteries, including those of sexual generation. See Holy of Holies. So, first, in the oldest system, we find the moon always male. There were a few reasons why the moon was considered to be male in ancient cultures. First, in the earliest cosmologies, including Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Vedic India, the moon was seen as an active fertilizing force. Male lunar gods like Sin in or Sin in Mesopotamia, Khonsu in Egypt, and Soma in India were linked to fertility, generation, and wisdom. Also, the moon's control over tides, crops, oops, and conception was seen as an active masculine potency. Finally, the moon was seen as partner to the female Earth, Mother Earth, who was universally seen as the Great Mother. If Earth is the womb, then the moon was imagined as the male consort who fertilized her with his light and rhythms. Osiris Lunus and Isis personified this energetic relationship. Okay, thoughts or questions? Next, thus Soma, with the Hindus, a kind of sidereal Don Juan, a king and the father, albeit illegitimate, of Buddha wisdom, which relates to occult knowledge, a wisdom gathered through a thorough acquaintance with lunar mysteries, including those of sexual generation. So Soma occupies a dual role in the ancient Vedic imagination. He is at once the moon god, Chandra, a radiant male deity who traverses the heavens, and the sacred ritual drink, an intoxicating elixir that bestows divine ecstasy and immortality. In both forms, he is described as kingly, luminous, and irresistible, a figure bound to fertility, desire, and the renewal of life. Myth tells us that Soma fathered Buddha, the planet Mercury, not Gotama Buddha, right? Through his union with Tara, the wife of Brihaspati or Jupiter. the moon as Soma is, as HPB puts it, a sidereal Don Juan, a kind of cosmic seducer. Yet from this union comes not another force of desire, but Buddha, the principle of wisdom. Thus, the myth suggests that true knowledge is born from penetrating the concealed and even forbidden mysteries of nature. Here, the lunar mysteries of fertility and generation. This stands at the heart of ancient magic, right? You unravel the mysteries of nature and you become empowered by them. And back to the text. Later on, when the moon became connected with female goddesses, with the Diana, Isis, Artemis, Juno, etc., that connection was due to a thorough knowledge of physiology and female nature, physical as much as psychic. So in the Greco-Roman world, the moon was personified as Artemis among the Greeks, as Diana in Rome, both virgin huntresses, but also protectors of childbirth and fertility. In Egypt, Isis, though not originally a lunar goddess, absorbed lunar aspects in the Hellenistic period, becoming linked with the moon's cycles of fertility and renewal. Juno Lucina in Rome was invoked at childbirth. Her epithet Lucina, she who brings to light, connecting her with the moon's role in conception and delivery. Okay, let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the term female goddesses. Could we get a reader, please?
Nadelle, can you read that, please?
If instead of being taught in Sunday schools useless lessons from the Bible, the armies of the ragged and poor were taught astrology, so far at any rate as the occult properties of the moon and its hidden influences on generation are concerned, then there would be little need to fear increase of the population, nor to resort to the questionable literature of the Malthusians for its arrest. For it is the moon and her conjunctions that regulate conceptions, and every astrologer in India knows it. During the previous and present races, at least at the beginning of this one, those who indulged in marital relations during certain lunar phases that made those relations sterile were regarded as sorcerers and sinners. But even now, those sins of old, based on the occult knowledge and the abuse of it, would appear preferable to the crimes of today, which are perpetrated because of the complete ignorance of and disbelief in all occult influences.
Thank God HPB isn't alive now, huh? Okay, first, if instead of being taught in Sunday schools useless lessons from the Bible, the armies of the ragged and the poor were taught astrology, so far at any rate as the occult properties of the moon and its hidden influences on generation are concerned, then there would be little need to fear increase of the population, nor to resort to the questionable literature of the Malthusians for its arrest. HPB here tells us that if the poor were taught the lunar laws of fertility and generation, they would have a natural means of regulating conception. And if they were to do so, there would be no need for the 19th century advocates of population control inspired by one Thomas Malthus. Next. For it is the moon and her conjunctions that regulate conceptions, and every astrologer in India knows it. During the previous and the present races, at least at the beginning of this one, those who indulged in marital relations during certain lunar phases that made those relations sterile were regarded as sorcerers and sinners. Ooh, different times. So in Vedic astrology, called Jyotish, the moon governed fertility, conception, and the rhythms of the body, especially in women. Ancient Indian astrologers taught that certain, and I'm sure it's still taught, certain lunar phases and conjunctions were favorable for conception, while others rendered unions sterile. Those who ignored these lunar laws and engaged in relations during sterile phases were regarded as sorcerers and sinners, because to go against cosmic law was seen as a waste of the generative force, which was considered sacred. Thus, misuse of sexual energy was equated with black magic, a diversion of life force away from its proper creative channel. Finally, but even now, those sins of old, based on the occult knowledge and the abuse of it, would appear preferable to the crimes of today, which are perpetrated because of the complete ignorance of and disbelief in all such occult influences. So, without awareness of the moon's influence or of the sacred laws of generation, people act blindly, driven by materialism and desire. This isn't sorcery in the old sense, but is seen as more destructive because it arises from being disconnected from the cosmic order. Okay, back to the text. Next up, please, reader.
Janet, can you read that, please?
Primarily, the sun and the moon were the only visible, and so to say, tangible by their effects, psychic and physiological deities. The father and the sun, while space and air in general, or that expanse of heaven called Nut by the Egyptians, was the concealed spirit or breath of the two. These, father and son, were interchangeable in their functions and worked harmoniously together and their effects upon terrestrial nature and humanity. Hence, they were regarded as one, though two in personified entities. They were both males, and both had their distinct and also collaborative work in the causative generation of humanity. So much from the astrological and cosmic standpoints viewed and expressed in symbolic languages, which became in our last races theological and dogmatic. But beyond this veil of cosmic and astrological symbols, there were the occult mysteries of anthropography and the primeval genesis of man.
Thank you, Janet. So first, but primarily, the sun and moon were the only visible and, so to say, tangible by their effects, psychic and physiological deities. The father and the sun, while space and air in general, or that expanse of heaven called Nut by the Egyptians, was the concealed spirit or breath of those two. So psychically, the sun provides the vitality of outer livingness, or what the Egyptians called day consciousness, whereas the moon influences moods, imaginations, dream, and night consciousness. Ancient cultures read these two as divine agencies that continually acted on their psyches. Physiologically, the sun governs heat, light, circadian rhythms, and the seasons, whereas the moon modulates tides, menstrual and fertility cycles, and sleep. Synthesizing these two is Nut. By the way, well, modern Egyptologists spell it N-U-T. The goddess who personifies the arching sky. the all-embracing expanse. She is both the womb and field of manifestation, the subtle medium in which the solar and lunar influences become potent and effective. She also serves as the receptive matrix through which the great breath moves, animating and harmonizing the solar and lunar forces. Next. These father and son were interchangeable in their functions and worked harmoniously together in their effects upon terrestrial nature and humanity. Hence, they were regarded as one, though two impersonified entities. They were both males and both had their distinct and also collaborative work in the causative generation of humanity. So the sun and moon as father and son were regarded as one because they present a single balanced agency or identity appearing through two complementary personas. They were considered interchangeable in their functions because both were seen as causative powers in life's rhythms. For example, solar vitality and lunar periodicity both co-produce growth, fertility, and cyclical renewal. Next. So much from the astronomical and cosmic standpoint, viewed and expressed in symbolical language, which became in our last races theological and dogmatic. So first, ancient peoples encoded their understanding of cosmic beings and their rhythms in symbolic language, which expressed cosmic laws in imagery, which revealed, for those able to understand, the more esoteric aspects of the ageless wisdom, while at the same time providing through the same imagery symbols that made sense to the collective consciousness. That's why these symbols were so effective, is they embedded in the same symbol could be meanings that would speak, so to speak, to different stages of awareness. Unfortunately, what began as flexible esoteric imagery later became rigid dogma, especially in later religious traditions. And often the symbols were mistook for what they were supposed to symbolize and worshiped on their own. Finally, but behind this veil of cosmic and astrological symbols, there were the occult mysteries of anthropography and the primeval genesis of man. Okay, behind this veil, the veil refers to the outer layer of myth and astronomy. Anthropography is the occult science of the human constitution, which maps the principles, vehicles, and subtle non-physical anatomy of man. The primeval genesis of man refers to humanity's esoteric origins, which details the descent of spiritual principles into matter. So for those with eyes to see, Egyptian symbology reveals, HPB here suggests, both humanity's esoteric origins and the occult science of the human constitution. Okay. Next up, let's see if we lost BL.
Not yet, but I'm getting ready to leave, so.
Okay, all right.
Bye, everybody. Do you need a reader?
Yes, thank you. That'll be your last great act.
Okay, Ariane, can you please read that?
And in this, no knowledge of symbols, or even the key to the post-Diluvian symbolical language of the Jews, will or can help save only with reference to that which was laid down in national scriptures for exoteric uses. The sum of which, however, cleverly veiled, was only the smallest portion of the real primitive history of each people, often relating, moreover, as in the Hebrew scriptures, merely to the terrestrial human, not divine life of that nation. That psychic and spiritual element belonged to mystery and initiation. There were things never recorded in scrolls, but in Central Asia, on rocks, and in subterranean crypts. Nevertheless, there was a time when the whole world was, quote, of one lip and of one knowledge, end quote. A man knew more of his origin than he does now, and thus knew that the sun and moon, however large a part they do play in the constitution, growth, and development of the human body, were not the direct causative agents of his appearance on earth. These agents being, in truth, the living and intelligent powers which the occultists call Dian Chodhans.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, first, and in this, no knowledge of symbols, or even the key to the post-Diluvian symbolical language of the Jews, will or can help, save only with reference to that which was laid down in national scriptures for exoteric uses, the sum of which, however cleverly veiled, was only the smallest portion of the real primitive history of each people, often relating, moreover, as in the Hebrew scriptures, merely to the terrestrial human, not the divine life of that nation. So, as you probably know, post-Diluvian means after the flood. So symbols and scriptures are exoteric veils. They preserve fragments of ancient wisdom, but cannot, in and of themselves, unlock the full occult mysteries. To reach the quote-unquote real primitive history, one must go beyond symbolic decoding into a direct esoteric understanding. Next. Also, we might say that there's levels of symbols, right? Sinzar, which is the primordial language of the gods, which reveals its meaning by simply beholding the ideograms that it's made up of, substands all these outer symbols that we use, geometrical and otherwise, right? So much can be gained by if you're privileged enough to come across a truer series or level of symbols. Next, that psychic and spiritual element belonged to the mystery and initiation. There were things never recorded in scrolls, but as in Central Asia, on rocks and in subterranean crypts. So the deepest teachings concerning the soul, spirit, and occult constitution of man have never been available to the public. There's the introduction to the secret doctrine is fantastic material about these huge caverns filled with writings that have ever been sealed to any kind of public view. Mystery here means that those sacred realities that were and are the secrets of the mystery schools. Initiation refers to the transformative process by which one is admitted into the mysteries. Of course, the most profound truths have always remained unwritten in order to prevent distortion and misuse. HPB then seems to suggest, with quote, in Central Asia on rocks and in subterranean crypts, that esoteric teachings were recorded on stone. Probably these subterranean chambers have never been open to or found by the public. This type of thing is controlled by unseen forces that are set in place by white magicians so that they're not accidentally uncovered until such time as the public is ready to witness them. Next. Nevertheless, there was a time when the whole world was, quote, of one lip and of one knowledge, and man knew more of his origins than he does now. One lip suggests that in pre-Diluvian times, before the Kali Yuga, humanity shared a common tongue and symbolic system. And one knowledge suggests a unified wisdom tradition, a collective awareness of cosmic and human origins. Part of the restoration of the plant will be to bring that ageless wisdom back to the fore. Excuse me just a minute. Next. And thus new that the sun and moon, however large a part they do play in the constitution, growth, and development of the human body, were not the direct causative agents of his appearance on earth. These agents being, in truth, the living and intelligent powers, which the occultists call Dian Chohans. So, though the sun and moon profoundly shape the constitution, regulate our daily rhythms and growth, they are not the ultimate originators of human existence. This distinction belongs to the Dian Chohans, who are those higher intelligences, the gods or divine architects who shape human principles and animate our psychic and spiritual constitution, like the Manasaputras who overshadow us and send us forth into incarnation. Okay, any thoughts or questions? You guys are awfully quiet this time. All right, next up, could we get a reader, please? Let's see here. Let me pull this up. Kirsten, can you read?
Yes.
Thank you.
As to this, a very learned admirer of the Jewish esotericism tells us that the Kabbalah says expressly that Elohim is a general abstraction, what we call in mathematics a constant coefficient or a general function entering into all construction. Not particular. That is by the general ratio 1:3:1:4:1:5, the astrodynamic and Elohistic figures. To this, the Eastern occultist replies, "Quite so. It is an abstraction to our physical senses. To our spiritual perceptions, however, and to our inner spiritual eye, the Elohim or Dianis are no more an abstraction than our soul and spirit are to us. Reject the one and you reject the other, since that which is the surviving entity in us is partly the direct emanation from and partly those celestial entities themselves."
Thank you, Kirsten. So first, as to this, a very learned admirer of the Jewish esotericism tells us that the Kabbalah says expressly that Elohim is a general abstraction. Okay, so the this in as to this refers to the immediately preceding statement, these agents being in truth the living and intelligent powers, which the occultists called the Yanchohas. So HPB is here making the point that even the Jews, with their tendency to personify godlike agencies, recognize that the Elohim are a universal functional principle that operates across all acts of creation, that they are a formative potency rather than a single individuated God. The Dianchohans are presented similarly, intelligences or powers that embody and administer creative law without being limited to a human-like persona. Next, what we call in mathematics a constant coefficient or a general function entering into all construction, not particular. So she's drawing a metaphor here, which emphasizes the universal law-like application of the principles represented by the Elohim and Dianchohans, which enter into every act of formation. So though these principles are intelligent, conscious powers, they operate through lawful, predictable modes comparable to mathematical functions. Next, that is by the general ratio 1 to 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, the astrodianic and Elohistic figures. This suggests that both the Elohim and the Dianchohans operate according to the law expressed by pi, which is the ratio that relates a circle to its diameter. Generally speaking, a diameter represents the form aspect and the circle the spirit aspect, though this isn't cut and dry. There are other applications. Of course, we have no specific info here, given here on how pi is used by quote unquote astrodianic and Elohistic figures, but we might hypothesize that if these formative agents operate by imposing circular or spherical symmetry, as well as rotational dynamics during their creative process, pi would be a natural law to govern that process. Yes, Martha.
This is a really basic question, Francis, but would this translate, this very careful explanation, would it translate to into what we see in the cosmic fire, the planes of existence? Is that the, somehow there's a part of me that says this is very simple, and yet one has to be clear about how to, I happen to think this is living, what's being said continues to live today in current thought process. Would we merely describe this as they're defining different planes of existence in the level and an abstract level, like we have Buddhic plane, Atmic, monadic plane? Well, is this how they're trying to break it down?
The short answer would be yes, but there's a little more to it. The Dianchohans are the angelic hosts, or the David hosts, right? And they create both the environment, which are those seven subplanes of the cosmic physical planes, as well as the hosts themselves, which you could say emerge from these great Deva lords, right, in order to do, or are activated by these.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
In order to do the work of form building for that plane. Thus, they provide the form for the intelligences that will inhabit that plane. This is the whole process of involution, is to go deeper and deeper and deeper progressively over time until the physical plane, as we know it, is reached, right? And that is their work, yes. So, you know, it makes sense to me that, you know, this ratio, the pi ratio, is fundamental to the Dionic and Eloistic types, because, you know, we're told that we are essentially spherical in our true nature, you know, and all life forms express themselves through the sphere in this way, even though that we don't see that manifesting on the physical plane, that if you go up into the higher planes, that spherical quality dominates the form aspect. Yes, Martha, you hand back up.
You're answering exactly what I asked. And isn't pi 314 or something, that the number of pi is that? And I thought of the triadic dynamic that we speak of. And again, is that relevant or is that not?
314.15 is the ratio of 1 to that figure, 3.1415. But there's also a lot could be done with the numerology of this. You know, the 314.15 adds to 14. And then if you add the 1, it adds to 15. There's various permutations. That's the dual 7, the higher and the lower 7, which represent the causal levels. For instance, the 7 rays. And then the levels of manifestation, for instance, the principles of a human being, which have their relation to the ray energies. Barbara.
Yes, I'm thinking of Pythagoras, who spoke about these ratio laws that are throughout the whole of the cosmos. In addition, that the gods make these up, but they do have some role in a differentiation of the laws for particular circumstances.
Well said.
So that they have a certain kind of intelligence that goes beyond the automaticity of the ratio.
Yeah, that's very well said. You know, for instance, the Dion Chohans of this solar system will move in accordance to the laws of the solar system, which are dominated by the love wisdom and that expression, right? Also, where we are in the progression of this solar system determines what manifests. So the cyclic unfolding of the Dionysus Chohan's manifestations is in accordance with law, you know, and the mathematical permutations of that law. So yeah, there's, you know, you have the first and second logos, universally speaking, which is the extension of the one and into manifestation, right? And that takes the form of spirit and matter, which immediately develops the third aspect, which is the sun, the S-O-N, which is consciousness, that results from the coming together of the first and second logos of spirit and matter. And that sonship then demonstrates in myriads of different ways, depending on what environment it is subject to, right? In other words, it comes into form, that consciousness aspect comes into form according to the local environment. But the universal is always spirit and matter. Okay, next. To this, the Eastern occultist replies, quite so, to what? Let's see here. Right. That is by the general ratio 1, 2, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, the astrodynamic and eloistic figures. To this, that Eastern occultist replies, quite so. It is an abstraction to our physical senses. To our spiritual perceptions, however, and to our inner spiritual eye, the Elohim or Dianis are no more an abstraction than our soul and spirit are to us. So yes, the Kabbalistic claim that from the standpoint of material consciousness, the Elohim and Dian Chohans are abstractions is true, but once one's higher senses are developed, the Elohim Dianis become as real and immediate as one's own soul. You know, there's this, in the unfolding of the sense of taste at the mental level, the sense of taste becomes discrimination. At astral levels, it's imagination. At mental levels, it's discrimination. But what that discrimination is the ability to determine the vibratory nature of different beings that are out of form. You know, that could be a particular master of wisdom. It could be an ashram. It could be any of these Dianis or Elohim, where you come into recognition through this potency of discrimination. And that's on the, you know, that's very much tied with the next level of the sense of taste, which is the intuition, you know, where that's the Buddhic sense. And that's where you also have divine vision and you're able to actually experience these greater beings with those higher senses through your developed Buddhic sheath. You're literally participating in their world at that point. Okay. And finally, reject the one and you reject the other, since that which is the surviving entity in us is partly the direct emanation from and partly those celestial entities themselves. So to deny the existence of the Dhyani Chohan's Elohim is to deny the existence of the soul, because the Dhyanis build the sheaths of the higher triad, which allows the monadic essence to demonstrate as Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. Okay, how are we doing? it's intense material, but that's not unusual. Could we get a reader, please? Oh, let's see here. Let me pull somebody up. We just did Kirsten. How about Nadell? You with us?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks.
One thing is sure, the Jews were perfectly acquainted with sorcery and various maleficent forces, but with the exception of some of their great prophets and seers, like Daniel and Ezekiel, Enoch, belonging to a far distant race, not to any nation, but to all, as a generic character, they knew little of, nor would they deal with the real divine occultism, their national character being averse to anything which had no direct bearing upon their own ethical, tribal, and individual benefits. Witness their own prophets and the curses thundered by them against the stiff-necked race. But even the Kabbalah plainly shows the direct relation between the Sephiroth or Elohim and men.
Thank you, Nadal. Okay, first, one thing is sure. The Jews were perfectly acquainted with sorcery and various maleficent forces. So Jewish esotericists, especially Kabbalists, had, HPB here suggests, a deep knowledge of magical practices, which is ritual manipulation of forces. Not necessarily evil, but always involving the technical use of occult laws. The point is that knowledge of occult forces is morally neutral. It can be used for initiation or for sorcery. Jewish mysticism, like other traditions, preserved both aspects. Next, but with the exception of some of their great prophets and seers, like Daniel and Ezekiel, Enoch, belonging to a far distant race and not to any nation but to all as a generic character, they knew little of, nor would they deal with, the real divine occultism. Okay, so Daniel is described as having understanding in all visions and dreams, which can be interpreted as what DK calls the Buddhic divine vision, that's sight on Buddhic levels. The book of Daniel contains elaborate visions of beasts and empires and cosmic events that are seen as encoding universal laws of cycles and hierarchies and divine order. Ezekiel's Merkabah vision of wheels, living creatures, and radiant light corresponds to occult archetypes of interlocking cycles and hierarchies of cosmic order and spiritual ascent. In Enoch's vision, and remember, HPB says he doesn't really belong to the Jewish tradition, that he, even though they claim it, he was from a much earlier time. So in his visions, he is shown the tablets of heaven and instructed to read the record of cosmic law and human destiny. The book of Enoch, often quoted in this secret doctrine, is filled with allegories of cosmic law, angelic hierarchies, and esoteric wisdom. In the second volume of the secret doctrine, HPB says, Taught Hermes is a generic name, as is Enoch, Enichion, the inner spiritual eye, Nebo, the prophet and seer, etc. It is not the proper name of any one living man, but a generic title of many adepts. So this passage suggests that except for these few important seers, Jewish esotericists largely avoided and or lacked access to true divine occultism, remaining instead within the sphere of sorcery and astral forces. Next, their national character being averse to anything which had no direct bearing upon their own ethnical, tribal, and individual benefits. Witness their own prophets and the curses thundered by them against the quote-unquote stiff-necked race. So the Hebrew people were primarily concerned with practical, tribal, survival and prosperity. Thus, their religious practices and revelations were interpreted through the lens of national identity and benefit, rather than any kind of universal wisdom for all humanity. And finally, but even the Kabbalah plainly shows the direct relation between the Sephiroth, or Elohim, and men. So in spite of the circumscribed focus of all but a few of their priests and prophets, the Jewish mystical tradition found in the Kabbalah, the connection between Elohim and men through the Sephiroth, or the Tree of Life. Okay, let's see, how are we doing? Yeah, we have a few minutes. Could we get a reader, please? Let me pull somebody up. You can see how automatic my request is. Selena, can you read for us? You have to unmute yourself. Are you with us? Maybe not. Okay, how about Vivian?
Therefore, when it is proved to us that the Kabbalistic identification of Jehovah with Bina, a female Sephiroth, has still another, a sub-occult meaning in it, then and then only the occultist will be ready to pass the palm of perfection to the Kabbalist. Until then, it is asserted that as Jehovah is in the abstract sense of a one living God, a single number, a metaphysical figment, and a reality only when put in his proper place as an emanation and a Sephiroth, we have a right to maintain that the Zohar, as witnessed by the Book of Numbers, at any rate, gave out originally before the Christian Kabbalists had disfigured it, and still gives out the same doctrine that we do, i.e., it makes man emanate, not from one celestial man, but from a septenary group of celestial men or angels, just as in Pymander, the thought divine.
Okay, we're going to have to pull the plug here. We'll analyze this next time. Okay, the next, we're coming into the holidays, so everything gets jumbled up. In fact, today was, I think, in conflict with the new moon, or when it would normally be, which would be next Sunday, was in conflict with something. And we may have trouble with a treatise on cosmic fire, which is slated for the 26th. That's the fourth Friday. But at this point, that will be our next meeting. And then following that, and many of you already heard this announcement, I'll be starting a whole new webinar series on The Light of the Soul. It's a unique book, which was co-authored by DK and Alice Bailey. And that starts on the 4th of January. It really is a deep, it's a translation of the Sutras of Patanjali, and it's a deep exploration of the method of bridging the gap between personality and soul, a minute exploration of that. So I'm really hoping you'll join me for that series, which starts in the new year on January 4th, same time as this, at 8 o'clock UTC. So until then, thank you all. I really appreciate you joining, and I will see you for a treatise on cosmic fire on the 26th. Have wonderful holidays, and talk to you then. Be well. Bye-bye.